Amy Hall here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You ready, Greg? Let's get right into this. Sure. I think we spent a lot of time chatting in either the last one or the one before
that.
So here's one from Jason Boggs. I've heard the argument, quote, we develop morality out of our desire to survive. How does that argument fail to stand as a basis for morality, i.e. not stealing or killing increases my chance of survival?
Well, first of all, that's not an argument. What it is a claim. It's a statement. The question I would ask, and this goes back to our foundational game plan, is first of all, I want clarification of what that means, although one might think it's fairly obvious. But the second thing is I'm going to know, why do you think that that is, in fact, the explanation of morality? Now, notice a couple of things about this claim. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give reasons why I don't think this is an accurate claim, even in the absence of somebody else giving reasons it is an accurate claim and they need to do it. Because what they're claiming is our entire moral project is simply tied to self-interest. Right? I mean, I think that's a fair way to sum it up. The irony, though, is part of our moral project is to deny self-interest. Part of what morality entails is saying no to yourself and yes to others, even at your own expense. Now, I know some of these evolutionary morality guys have really worked hard to contrive ways of understanding these interconnected relationships so that even self-sacrificial behavior might be characterized as selfish for the group. But when you're an individual member of the group, why should you care about the group? You know, that's part of assuming the morality you're trying to explain. I think that it turns out when you look at the fullness of the moral project, there's tons of things that cannot be explained in that way. I think self-sacrifice is an example of that, and that's a huge problem for people to deal with. And this is where they've done a lot of the maneuvering. Okay, now, but and this I talk about in one of the closing chapters of this relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. I call it monkey morality because I look and see whether this evolutionary kind of characterization is going to be good. Although this way of putting it doesn't necessarily imply that we evolved these things, but rather that we decide these things for our corporate good. But notice some people don't decide things for the corporate good. Why is the corporate good? What the heck is that? The corporate good? Notice that we are trying to define morality by using moral terms. Well, you can't use moral terms in your explanation of morality. Here, we develop the good, we invent that for the corporate good. Wait. You can't have the thing you're trying to define in the language of your definition. What is the corporate good? And that turns out to be different for different people. This is why we have different political parties, because the concept of the corporate good differs between different groups who have different values. All right. So, I mean, one way of answering this question is to simply try to get a broad understanding of what the moral project entails and see if the explanation that is being offered makes sense of all of these things. Okay. Morality just doesn't consist of actions. The moral project doesn't just consist of actions. If we have two grandchildren that do favors for grandma, and they are equal in their actions, they each have similar kinds of actions that, taken on their own, are nice things to be done for grandma. But we know that one is doing it because they love grandma, and the other one doesn't love grandma at all but wants to be put in grandma's will. Now, notice that the physical actions are the same. But because the intention of the heart is different, we all consider that a morally inferior act. Well, in what sense is it morally inferior in light of this other explanation? What is the difference? A man goes into somebody else's garage and takes the hose and walks out with it. Okay, is that wrong? Well, yeah, he's stealing it. No, what if he had permission? Well, if he has permission to use it, then he's not stealing, he's borrowing. But notice that the physical act is the same. The only difference is something that's non-physical, the issue of permission. And so the point I'm making is there are all kinds of elements in our moral project that that are not things that can be captured with simply a kind of socialized explanation we are doing this for the corporate good. Or how could you read that line again? And how
we develop morality out of our desire to survive.
Out of our desire to survive. Well, look at there. Stalin survived quite well. So did Mao. Okay. So did Lenin. So did Pol Pot. So did a whole bunch of people who used their power to do what most people would consider to be terribly wicked acts. Okay? So I want to make another point, too, about this that is lost on those who advance this as an adequate explanation for a morality. Because on this view, what we are doing is we are constructing a system that simply helps us survive better. So survival is the goal, and the means to survival are up to us. So the individuals or the individual groups, let me put it this way, the subjects decide what is right or wrong based on survivability. All right. Now, when conditions change regarding survivability, then the rules that improve survivability change to accommodate that. Okay, that's nothing wrong with that in that system. But notice that on this view, all moral rules are grounded in the subject. That means no moral rule is objective in itself. It's always subjectivistic, which means it's relativistic. So, is rape wrong? That's the question. And the answer is, well, that depends. If it hurts our survivability, then it's going to be wrong for us at that time. If it helps our survivability, then it's a good thing for us in that time. Now, some might argue, well, wait, rape is more complex than that. You know, it really helps our survivability in a very complex way. All right, I'm just using that as an example. My point is, even if you can try to do an end around, which I think it's going to be hard, even with rape, to say this is somehow on the big scene something that helps our survivability. Because the fact is, if there are more rapes, there are more pregnancies. And if there are more pregnancies, there are more people surviving. I mean, let's face it. That's pretty straightforward. The fact is, though, that morality is completely subjective. There is no obligation not to rape. There is just a rationale that if we do that, at least on this view, that it somehow, who knows, decreases our survivability. All right. And so I don't think this is adequate, because it turns out that nothing is wrong in itself. It is only wrong relative to a set of circumstances called survivability. And we are the ones who decide those rules. Just like the questioner said, we develop it based on survivability, which means all of this kind of explanation turns out to be completely relativistic. There are no objective moral rules. We do what we deem best for survivability in the moment. And by the way, this was Hitler's project. I'm 300 pages into the massive 1,200-page The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And this was Hitler's project. Our survivability as an Aryan race dictates the policies of aggression and cruelty and murder that we have universal across the country. I'm in 1935 now, and he is already an iron-fisted dictator just 2 years into his reign. 1933, he became chancellor. And in 1934 was the big purge, the big first big purge that set the stage for everything that follows. But that's his plan right there. We make our rules for our survivability. So what is the moral argument against that? Last thing here, very quickly, if this is an adequate explanation of morality, there can be no problem of evil. Because the problem of evil is the observation that across the world, people are not doing the way they're supposed to do it. They're breaking some law that is above everybody. There's got to be a law above the law for there to be a problem of evil, which is the rationale for the Nuremberg trials after the war. Yeah, you did what your culture decided was right, but that's not right. There is a law above the law that we are all beholden to. And that's what the judges at Nuremberg adjudicated against war criminals and what we do today against war criminals. So anyway, these are some of the problems. I know you're jumping to get in here, so I'll stop talking for a moment.
Well, I just want to know, maybe one thing you could ask them is, can anyone be wrong about their morality, and how could they be? How could anything be wrong? Because maybe they don't survive as well?
Well, it's utilitarian in that regard, or consequentialistic in that regard, that we are doing everything to fulfill the utility of what survival of, by the way, is that the survival of individuals, or is that survival of the species, or is that survival for all life on the planet? I mean, that's a big part of ethics right now, that humans have no special role. We have to care about all life on the planet. So that is an ambiguity of that view. And, how do you sort that out?
Well, one thing that seems fatal to me to this is the idea that it seems to me pretty obvious that surviving is not the highest moral good. And I think we understand that. We see there are all sorts of things that we think are worth dying for. And we admire people who die for things, even if they're not causing anyone else to survive by dying.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's obvious that survival is not the highest thing. But the second thing I would say is, where on this view would you have a sense of obligation? We have a sense of obligation because we are obligated to someone. You're not obligated to just rules about surviving. That's not a thing. So
that's
where does
self-interest,
this...
it's not obligation. We're back to that point again.
Right. Yeah. So why do people feel obligated? Why do people feel guilt? Where does this sense of obligation come from? And that can only come from a personal source. Because you can't be obligated to
a rock.
An idea or a, you know, whatever.
a rock, you know. I have no obligations regarding my chair, you know, or the computer. I might have obligations to the people who paid for the computer, maybe stand a reason or something, but not to the computer or anything physical. That's a really good point. Obligations are held between persons.
So then someone might say, well, you're obligated to the other people to help them survive. But now the highest goal isn't survival because you're not the one surviving. So there's some other goal.
That's right.
Now there's some other thing higher than survival.
Right. Which creates the obligation to care about people surviving. That's right. Now you're moving above. And this is exactly what happens. They identify this thing down here as the key to morality, and then they cannot help in their thinking about it and describing it, smuggling in morality at a higher level to do the work that they need it to do to make the lower level moral explanation work, okay, like survival. And what this shows is they understand that there is a higher morality than mere survival. And by the way, why people are giving their lives all the time, even right now, although I think you're right about this, that we intuitively know that there's something more important than survival. And this is why people give their lives, or at least stand up in the line of fire and put themselves at risk for something greater. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have wars. Okay. Let me put it this way. We wouldn't be willing to fight a war and risk our lives unless there was something higher like liberty. Give me liberty or give me death to fight for. Now, I do think that's changing to some degree. And I think, ironically, COVID is an example of that. Because as one person said early on in all of this, when the restrictions started coming down, he said that Americans have always been willing to risk their lives for the value of their way of life. But in this situation, like the governor of New York or the mayor of New York City said, if we say save one single life with all of these restrictions, then that's worth it. And notice now, not dying is the summum bonum. It's the greatest good, even if lives are destroyed, as they have been over the last 6 months, across the board. And by the way, lots and lots of people dying as a result of the restrictions. So I think a bit of this turmoil in our culture right now is a struggling with this idea. Are we willing to die for something greater, like the benefit of society in general, or for a way of life? Or are we going to surrender everything just so that some lives might be spared in the process?
Well, there's so much more to say about morality and the grounding for it. Obviously, we can't cover that in this short amount of time. So I recommend Greg's book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, because it goes into a lot more detail mm-hmm. about this. And we'll back up the things that we've said here in case you're saying, but what about this? But what about this? Well, there are a lot of things we didn't cover. So I recommend that book.
Co-authored with Frank Beckwith. Yes. He did half the work.
All right. So let us do one more here. This one comes from Chris Kinn. After reading Hebrews 12, 5 through 11, would God discipline the one he loves without making it known to that person that God is, in fact, disciplining him or her? And if not, how can a Christian know when they are being disciplined versus experiencing a consequence of a sinful act?
Well, taking that last part of the question, it strikes me as a false dichotomy. It might be that God allows the consequence of a sinful act as part of the discipline. He's not protecting us from the consequence. He's letting us experience the consequence. Now, parents know this all the time, although we don't practice it probably as much as we should, because we have this protective instinct and we want to protect our children from the consequence of their act. All right. I just saw a great little PragerU video about teaching your children about money. And it's Dave Ramsey's daughter who did it. And she gave three principles. But one of them was that when they've earned their money and spent their money, it's over with. It's gone. And so you don't cover them. So she went, as she described, to with her family when she was younger with money she had earned. And this was part of the program that she was suggesting. And she went to the carnival and she went to some booth and she spent every dime she had trying to win a teddy bear or something, you know. Well, within the first 10 minutes, she was broke. But there are all kinds of other things at the carnival. So she went back to Dad and said, Dad, I want to, my money's gone. I need some for the Ferris wheel. I need some for popcorn. And he said, honey, when it's gone, it's gone. And that was it for the rest of the time. Now, notice what happened here. There was a consequence to her behavior, and that is when you spend your money, it's gone. But it was the father that was enforcing it, and he is refusing to step in and to shield her from the momentary painful consequence of her behavior. Now, this is years later, she's reflecting on this incident. So this girl learned her lesson right there. So this is what I mean as a false dichotomy. Sometimes it is the consequence of the actions that is being used by the father, earthly or heavenly, to teach us something. Okay. Now, as to the first part of the question, I think this is precisely why, how do we know when? This is precisely why this section is there in Hebrews 12. And I'm quite familiar with this passage because I've had to go back to it myself many times to remind myself that the difficulties and hardship that I am facing right now, God says, is part of the process of his training of me to be virtuous. And in fact, that's exactly what it says. Verse 11, I know this by heart, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful. This is no fun, but sorrowful. But afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Did I get that right? Yeah, there it is. Now, when it says afterwards, I don't think that means immediately afterwards. This is a process of our life that God is training us for a longer-term payoff, okay? And I heard this. I heard Tim Keller said this the other day while I was listening to a sermon that he did, Psalm 88, I think, which is a really downer psalm. It's one of the two psalms that start out as a downer and end as a downer, you know. And he cited some older woman when she was asked, how's she doing? And she was very frail and very sick and in a lot of pain. And she says, there's nothing wrong that a resurrection won't heal. The way she put it. And so what she had in view, and I think what God has in view, and the writer of Hebrews expresses here, is God on the long term. Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy somewhere, he says, bodily exercise is of small profit. Okay, you pump iron, you get a little bit out of it. But, you know, sooner or later you get old and tear your rotator cuff, you know, and things fall apart. Okay, that was from bench pressing for me. But godliness, by contrast, is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not only for this life. So godliness helps you here, but also for the life to come. And so the things that God is preparing us for in this life is not just to be cashed out in this life, but rather in the life to come. And this is the significance of this wonderful promise, clarification Paul offers in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 for momentary light affliction. And he says momentary and light, not because it feels momentary or light when we're experiencing it, but compared to eternity, it's momentary and light. Affliction is producing. It's the affliction that is producing the eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. So I think what we need to kind of personally ingest here when we read like passages like Hebrews 12 is we're being told that because we aren't aware that God is there with us, working with us, using this for our good. And so we have to be reminded, which is why we go back to these kinds of passages. In this world, you have tribulation, Jesus said, but be of good cheer, I've overcome it. Well, it doesn't look like it. And he said, yes, I have. Yes, I have. Hang in there. Same thing with Hebrews 12. And I don't want people to feel like, well, okay, God's discipline, I got it now, but why don't I feel any better? Where's that peaceful fruit of righteousness? Well, I think it comes in measure in this life somewhat as we are surrendered to the discipline God is offering and seeking to learn from it. But I think it also, its greatest realization is going to come in the life to come.
And Greg, you've been saying something here that you haven't really made explicit, but I want to make this explicit too. When this verse is not just talking about God disciplining us for doing something wrong. This is about God bringing suffering into our lives to discipline us, as similar to what you were saying about godliness has great profit, and you know we train our bodies, but God trains our souls, mm-hmm. And I think that's what this is talking about, because in verse 3 it says, "For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." And then he comes down and then he talks about God disciplining those he loves. Mm. So I think it encompasses every bit of suffering that we go through. It's for the purpose of God disciplining us, of developing our souls, of developing our character, of helping us to learn to trust him and learn to not give in to sin as we're suffering. That's something that the New Testament warns about also. That we're supposed to endure it. In fact, I think it even says that it is for discipline that you endure.
Right.
So that's verse 7. So this is about enduring the hardships that come our way, and sometimes those are as a result of our sin, and sometimes they're not as a result of our sin.
Like in Jesus' case, it wasn't a result of his
sin.
But he's the model, right?
But what the point here is that all of these things are coming from God, and that's why we get in Romans 8, all things are working together for good for those who love the Lord, because he's making us like Christ. He's conforming us to the image of his son.
I think a takeaway from a passage like this is that your sufferings and difficulties and hardships, call it the discipline of God in either sense, you're doing something wrong, or you're not, you're just being trained. I mean, people have I have a discipline of a workout or something like that. It's not because you're bad. It's because you're trying to attain something better than you are. Okay, that when these things happen, they are not wasted. Let me say it again, because this is really important. When these things happen, they are not wasted. If you're a Christian, for those who love him and are called according to his purpose, for you, lots of wasted pain and hardship in the world. But in Christ, they are not wasted. You are not suffering loss. You are gaining something. As hard as it is to think about this, see it that way right now. You are gaining something. Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and thieves can break in and steal, but rather lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust can destroy nor thieves can break in, because that's where your treasure is and that's where your heart's going to be. And I remember a line, and I'll just finish with this. My dad used to say, and my mom, I think, sometimes too, when I was a kid, we experienced hardship. My dad would say, offer it up. Offer it up. Now, we were Roman Catholic. I think that's a way of Catholics talking about these things, but I think it was good advice that sometimes you just give it to the Lord and let him take it, and then you take what he is going to give you through the experience of the hardship. You offer it up. Good advice.
And the last thing I want to say is that, just to remind you again, if we are going to take Romans 8 seriously, you have to trust that everything that comes your way has a purpose. There's nothing random that comes your way that God is not using for your good. And trusting him in that is the hard thing. I know that's the hard thing, but that's what we have to remember. There's no random suffering that comes our way. And we don't have to figure out what he's doing in that situation either. He will accomplish what he's setting out to accomplish. All we need to do is continue to act in a way that honors God in the situation that we're in. And that is our job.
Let him who suffers according to the will of God entrust himself to a faithful creator in doing what is right. That's 1 Peter 4, last couple of verses.
Yeah, 1 Peter has a lot to say about suffering. So that's a good one to read if you want more.
So I'm so glad we made this a shorter broadcast here. I mean, I'm looking at 28 minutes right now.
Sorry,
we
guys.
We just can't help ourselves.
All of you people who are using our podcast on your commute to work, if you have a commute still, maybe you don't even have one anymore.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for sticking with us. A few extra minutes today. Thanks for your questions. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.